So, dear Ajahn Brahm, can you tell the story of the man with the five wives whom he each asked to accompany him to his grave? It is a favourite of mine, but I can't remember all of it. You can't remember. There's only four wives, and you're not five. And four wives is enough suffering. Yeah, I said that a few days ago, though. I think I said it in Nolamara just a week ago, 2 weeks ago. Just to remind you of the stupid man with four wives. So he had four wives, and when he was about to die, he thought, I'm going to be lonely up in heaven without one of my wives. So he asked his most recent wife to come in. He said, darling, I'm about to die. I love you so much. And she said, I love you too, darling. Of course, yeah, sure. And she's a very attractive girl, really a hot lady. And she was so beautiful that she gave him a great reputation as a husband of this very beautiful girl. And because of her, he could go into the best of society, all the great parties and conventions, events just because of her. And when he said, darling, I'll be lonely without you, will you come with me? She said, no way. I'm not coming with you. All I'm going to do is to speak your praises. I'll give you a great eulogy at your funeral. That's as far as I'm going to go, okay? And he said, I thought you said you'd love me forever. He said, no, only until you die, and then I'll completely forget about you. I will disappear. Oh, he said, get out of here, you shameless hussy. And he brought his next wife in, his third wife, who he married before his fourth wife. And so he asked his third wife, wife, I'm about to die. I'll be lonely without you. And his third wife, she was also really attractive, but in a different way. And many men coveted that third wife. When they looked at her, they wanted her. And he said, darling, I'm about to die. I'll be lonely without you. Will you come with me beyond the grave? She said, no, it's never been done. I'm not going to do it. In fact, she said, after you die, I'm going to go with one of your sons. What? I'm not even dead yet and you're unfaithful to me? He said, look, what I'll do, I'll get you a great funeral. I'll get you the most lavish funeral, but I'm not going to do anything more. Get out of here, you shameless girl. And so, got a second wife in. His second wife wasn't all that attractive. No one actually lusted for her, but she was the person he could always go to in times of trouble. This was the lady, the woman, the second wife, who would always be there for him. And when he said, darling, I love you too. I'll be lonely without you. Will you go with me past death? And she said, no, I just can't. If I could, I would, but it just cannot be done. I will go to your gravesite, and I can go no further. Get out, he said. And then he asked for his first wife. His first wife, who'd been married to her for such a long time, he couldn't remember the time when she wasn't there. And he neglected his first wife of late, so she was dressed shabbily, very thin. But he still loved her and said, darling, I'd be lonely without you. I'm about to die. Will you go with me? And she said, of course, darling. I always go with you everywhere. That's why my name is Mrs. Karma. Because karma always goes with you. That's your first wife, your first husband. And the second wife will only go to the graveside. That's Mrs. Family. They'll always be there for you, always supporting and helping you. But at the death, they will be there at your graveside or the crematorium. But they can go no further. And the third wife, the one will go with your son or your daughter after you die, is your wealth. That won't go with you beyond the grave either. It's only your wealth will. And the last one is the Mrs. Fame, which you get last of all in life. And Mrs. Fame won't go with you either. All that Mrs. Fame will do will give you a good eulogy at your funeral about wonderful things you did in life. But after a short while, Mrs. Fame will just fade away and disappear. As your reputation, no matter how great, no one will remember you ever again. So that's a man with four wives, or four husbands. Or what if you're a monk? What if you say there's four fellow monks? And the only one who'll go with you is Venerable Karma. Okay, that's the four wise thing. I have a good friend who is a good meditator. Originally he told me he has a problem to see things vanishing in front of him while he was walking or driving. Wow, it's amazing, especially if the steering wheel vanishes. Maybe if the car vanishes, you may have hit it. He used to have this experience last time after he was getting out from deep meditation. He's afraid now and stops meditation. Is his meditation method wrongly practiced? How should I help him? Now, as I mentioned earlier, that sometimes that your perception can start to mess around when you do lots of meditation. But that's usually a stage which you go through. And after you get the sort of vanishing, the weird stuff which comes into your mind, then usually the nimittas come up. And the nimittas are much stronger, more beautiful and more useful. But when things vanish in front of you, just your perception is just messing around. And all you need to do is to program your mindfulness to say, this is when I meditate and this is when I'm going to watch my breath and make peace, be still, be kind. But when I'm out there working or driving my car, I will pay attention to the traffic, not to my breath. And I won't just make peace and be kind, be gentle in the same way that when I'm meditating. Here I've got to put attention at the task at hand. So when we talk about mindfulness, mindfulness should not be just about the breath or about the body. Mindfulness should be on the task at hand. So if you are sort of laying a bamboo floor, the monks are very mindful laying the bamboo floor. All their concentration was on laying the bamboo floor, not on their breath, not on their body, but on laying the bamboo floor when you're driving. You put your attention on driving, not on the meditation. So I think one of the things that the reason maybe why the thing started disappearing, because he hadn't washed his windscreen, I don't know, maybe that's one of the reasons. But it really shouldn't be happening, and it's really no need to be afraid. Because there is some sort of error in his meditation there somewhere. He's allowing sort of the deep meditations just to go into his daily life, and that's not really a good thing to do. So it's very hard to ask a question about, or answer a question about somebody else. Because you don't exactly know what he's doing, why he's doing it, so it's very hard. But when you're driving, I doubt that will ever happen, so I don't really worry about it. Dear respectable Ajahn, I hope I'm respectable. At least I'm be spectacled. In Mahayana Sutras, it defines samadhi in 8 stages and jhana in 4 stages. However, in Theravada, it's always mentioned samadhi in 4 stages of jhana only. Are the samadhi and jhana definition different between these two schools? No, the two schools are exactly the same. That's why when it gets to meditation, they say sort of samadhi in 8 stages and jhana in 4 stages. There is another way of calling it atta vimoka, the 8 freedoms or 8 liberations. This is just another framework to describe sort of the states of jhana and the arupa states. So you can put it one way, you can put it in the other way, depends how you want to sort of describe it. And it's all about the same thing. There's only one type of stillness. And remember that the different types of Buddhism, whether it's Mahayana, Theravada or Vajrayana, these are the main 3 types of Buddhism, what we call these days MTV Buddhism, Mahayana, Theravada and Vajrayana. Because MTV is a very common sort of name these days. So this is MTV Buddhism. We find we have a lot of commonality between us because we all follow the teachings of the Buddha. And teachings of the Buddha, they're the teachings of what happens to you when you meditate, when you get very still. And as it gets from meditation, it's exactly the same. So samadhi means stillness. And jhanas are those particular stages of stillness. What I call the deep stages of letting go. So it doesn't matter how you sort of, what tradition you are in, it doesn't matter what race you are, it doesn't matter what gender you are, it doesn't matter how old you are, sort of jhana is jhana is jhana, samadhi is samadhi is samadhi. It's all about the mind, not about the body. So there is no difference between those schools in a state of meditation, simply because that meditation is just part of the mind. Doesn't belong to any school. I am considering staying another week if I'm allowed. How would I go about organizing this? Well, first of all, you have to shave all your hair off, and then you have to get a brown robe, and then you can stay as long as you like. Jesus. Did I not mention that about Sailor 3? Now, if anybody, this is one of the nice things about having your own retreat center, because sometimes people are meditating, they actually do start really getting into it, and when it gets to sort of Sunday, and I have to go home. And it's wonderful if you are really enjoying it, and you don't have commitments, then you can stay on a bit longer. So all you have to do is just ask me, and just stay on a bit longer. Obviously, that you'd have to look after your own food. You can't all stay on longer, because that would be very difficult for catering. When most of you have to go home, you've got work commitments, family commitments, you've got air tickets and something or other. But if you do want to stay on, if it's about two or three of you, that's no trouble at all. You just stay on. And, you know, you just get your own breakfast things, cook them in your own cottage, and just walk over to the monastery for lunch. So you just carry on if you wish, especially if you're getting deep meditation. So we have the freedom to do this. Isn't it nice? So just come and ask me. In the Theravada sect, we don't have sects in Buddhism. In Theravada there is pure abode where only once return or non-returners can go after they have passed away to continue cultivation. May I know which realm does pure abode belong to? This is in, they have the, in Mahayana, sort of the Sudarvasa, the pure abodes. It's a bit sus in the sense that it was a sutta which was certainly begun, it was about 500, 600 years after the time of the Buddha, before Pure Land Buddhism emerged. And this is no conjecture now. If you're going to be a rationalist, you can actually date many of these teachings. You know exactly what was said by the Buddha, what came afterwards, and what came a long time after that. By that simple techniques of linguistic analysis, in the same way that many of you, if you, for example, read a book by Chaucer, and then you read Charles Dickens, and then you read Harry Potter, it's very easy to say which was earlier and which was later, because the language changes and the concepts change, and the vocabulary is different. So people can very easily date sort of works of literature. And people used that, first of all, with the Christian Bible to prove that much of that was many, many years, even the Gospels were many years after the time of Jesus. They weren't written by the disciples, were written after disciples of disciples, somehow or other. So they could actually date these ancient texts. And they used that same critical technique to start dating the Buddhist texts. And there you can actually find there's an earlier form of suttas. This is what the Theravadins follow. And the things like the Lotus Sutta or the Diamond Sutta or the Sutta of the Pure Abode, that came much, much later, way after the time of the Buddha, maybe 500, 600 years after the time of the Buddha. So we know this, the Pure Abode is a much later sutta. And it became very popular because imagine what it said. It said that all you need to do is remember the name of Amitabha Buddha and keep reciting that name. You don't have to keep any precepts. You don't have to sit for hours meditating. You don't have to give so much dana to the temples. All you need to do is to say Amitabha again and again and again, and then you're not just going to go to heaven, but you're going to go to heaven, and after heaven then you're going to become enlightened. So it's a great marketing package. You know, you get a lot of happiness, it's easy to do, you go to heaven and you get enlightened as well. And up in the heaven of the pure abodes, there, whatever you think of, for example, this evening you may be thinking of dinner, you just think of it and it's right there in front of you. You don't even have to order it or cook it, it's just right there. If you have any music, I remember Jimi Hendrix, and I can see Jimi Hendrix playing his guitar, immediately I think about it. Everything is right there for you. So they describe this amazing heaven realm, and you just stay in this heaven realm, and then when you die, then you go and get reborn with Amitabha and become fully enlightened. It's too good to be true, and it is too good to be true. It doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Anyone who knows about the mind say it's just a bit of wishful thinking. It's a great marketing tool, but you're being sold a dud. However, there is something said by the Buddha called the pure abiding. So these are the real Sudarvasa. And this is a place where the Anagamis go to. This is the people who are non-returners, who have let go of all attachment to the five senses and the body. The only other little attachment they have is the attachment to the joy of the jhana states, the mind bliss, all physical bliss that's completely transcended. And they go into these pure abodes. Now, to give you an idea what a non-returner is like, there are many descriptions of non-returners in the time of the Buddha, and even before then. One of the most famous of those non-returners is the person called Gatikara, who was a potter. And he was a non-returner. The only reason why he never became a monk and joined the Sangha was because his two parents were blind. And there's no one else to look after them. So he looked after his parents. That's the only reason he never became a monk. But this is how he looked after his parents. He was a potter. But he would not dig the earth to get the clay in case he destroyed any worms or beetles who lived in the earth. He would actually wait for the villagers to make the dikes on the paddy fields and just collect some of the earth left over. Or he'd actually collect earth from rabbit holes. So that's the earth he used to make his pots. And he never sold them for money. He didn't have any cash himself. And sometimes we talk about monks living simply, and this is a lay person living so simply, would not accept any money. He put his pots outside his workshop with a little sign, if you want to take a pot, just take it. If you want to leave any lentils and rice for me and my parents, just leave some. And that's just how he lived. It wasn't even barter, it was even more simple than that. He gave all his pots away, and people, out of a sense of generosity, left some money back. And this is exactly the same the way this retreat centre runs. Come and enjoy the retreat as much as you want. There's no charge. If you want to leave a donation afterwards, that's fine. But there's no business being done. That's why, you know, this is the sort of example which we'd like to follow. And he was celibate, he wore white, lived very simply. That was the anagami. Now that's just the amount of renunciation, the simplicity, which happens when you become a non-returner. One of the other non-returners was a lady, and she recounted how the king's soldiers came to arrest her son, who was suspected of doing a major crime, and they summarily executed him in front of his mother. Later they found out he was innocent. But even though they executed an innocent man and in front of his mother felt no sorrow or no ill will of seeing her son executed. So that's the amount of renunciation and detachment of a non-returner. Now you get some idea of how much letting go is happening for a non-returner. You've really left the world, just about. Obviously you'll try and protect your son, but if it can't be done, it's the law of karma, you let go. No attachment, it's not really your son anyway. The being who comes into your life, you look after them, but without any attachment. They come with their karma, and some of the karma you just can't do anything about. And that's the amount of lack of craving and attachment of a non-returner. So you can get some idea of their mind today. It's so pure and so peaceful. And for a person who's that type of attainment, then when they die, they go to the Sudarvasa. So let's see. It's not the Sudarvasa, what's it called again? Sorry? But anyway, they go to the place where the Anagamis go. And there they live for a long time. Basically they just get into their jhanas and enjoy themselves with the jhanas. Until just the last part of attachment to the bliss of the mind just vanishes, and then they just parinibbana from there. They never come back again. That's why they're called non-returners. So that was said by the Buddha. You can see it's a much more pure and high-minded state than just chanting for an Amitabha and going to a place where you get all these sensory pleasures and then becoming enlightened afterwards. I know that some monks have thought that maybe the idea of the pure abodes, the Western paradise, as they say. Actually, that many of you have travelled to the West. There's no paradise there. I don't know what they're talking about, France or England or United States. That's not a paradise. So I don't know about the Western paradise. So this pure abode, you can see that they're so sensual, it doesn't really make much sense for a Buddha, so that could be a path to enlightenment, indulging the senses. You just get more attached if you went to such a place. So it's learning how to let go of the senses and attachment to the senses, being more at peace with things no matter what happens. That's the way to enlightenment. So people might say it's a nice easy way, but really the easy way is no way. It's just a bit of a delusion that you can become enlightened that way. So that makes a bit of sense, the pure abodes and the Sudarasa. Next question. Which sutta did you quote when you told us yesterday about the Buddha telling Ananda about the misconception that sex was pleasant? I think that's in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So if you look at the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, there, it's just one of these things which you read and it just really stands out because it really goes against what many people think. There is another sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha says, the arahats, the enlightened ones, that what the world says is happiness, they say is suffering. What the world says is suffering, they say is happiness. Basically, the world gets it the wrong way around. So what does the world say is happiness? And one of those things is like sex. And the arahats say, no, that's a lot of suffering. Now that's actually quite hard to see, but you can understand what happens is just the way that delusion works on our mind. I mentioned this in my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. It's a part of Buddhism which he calls the vipalasas, a perversion of perception. And any psychologist knows how this works. For example, one of the most well-known perversions of a perception is falling in love. Because when you fall in love, if you're a boy and you fall in love with a girl, she's the most beautiful girl in the world. She's charming in every which way. She's absolutely perfect. And if you're the girl and you fall in love with a boy, oh, he's such a great guy. He's so charming. And you're just so lucky that he loves you back. Wow, I'm the luckiest girl in the whole world. And that's what people think. A few years later, when you're filing for divorce, why did I ever marry such a bastard? They're just so selfish and so cruel, and there's just no good features in them at all. Which one is true? Of course, neither of them is true. But you know, when you fall in love, you think that the other person is absolutely perfect. And yet, if you think that way, it's the perversion of perception. And then, after a while, you sort of hate them so much, you think there's nothing good about them whatsoever at all. That's again, perversion of perception again. You'll find they're just ordinary human beings, just like you. You're not perfect, but you're not that bad. You're just ordinary. However, when we have hatred, we think that person, they're not ordinary, they're really evil and bad, and fundamentally flawed. When we're in love, we think they're just absolutely perfect. You can see how we add these things onto reality. This is what we call the perversion of perception. And we think that these things are going to create happiness for us. And when we think that way, they do create a type of happiness, because that's what we expect. I remember as a kid, some of the things which were supposed to be great happiness, the first thing was beer, alcohol. I remember as a 14-year-old, all your friends said, oh yeah, beer is really good. It's really fun. Unless you have so many pubs and people drink this stuff. I remember as a 14-year-old sneaking into a pub pretending I was 16 or 18, I forget which, and taking your first pint, half a pint of beer, thinking you're a man now. Well, what really struck me was just how disgusting it tasted. Now, British beer, you know, if you really have a clear mind, it's a terrible thing. It's bitter, it's just yucky. But everybody liked it. And I thought, I must be really weird, I don't like this stuff. And so next, it took me a couple of years to actually to change my perception, so I liked it just to fit in. And then actually I did like it. And it really just showed me just how your perceptions are changed just by peer pressure, by cultural pressure. And in the end, you like what other people like, and you hate what other people hate. You're just totally conditioned, which is really real. And one of the biggest peer pressures is not for beer, but for sex. Sometimes I go into old books and you see, like being a boy, beautiful girls. And you look at like an old magazine, sort of 50 years ago, what a beautiful girl looked like. And they're ugly. And then you look sort of 20 years later. And then you look for when I was growing up, and they're really beautiful. And modern day girls are ugly again. You know, your fashions, you know, what is actually beauty? A lot of it is what you expect to be beauty. What other people tell you is beautiful. And then you believe it. So a lot of beauty is again totally conditioned. They have a saying in English, you know, one man's meat is another man's poison. One man's beautiful girl is another man's ugly girl. Well, what is beauty? Now, one man's curry is another man's poison. I don't know if you like the food here, but sometimes you like it, sometimes you don't. There's always one person who likes the food here, and there's always one person who doesn't like it. That's just nature. It's nothing to do with the food. This is what we add on to things. And so we've been so conditioned by our culture to think that sex is enjoyable. But now when we have sex, it is enjoyable. But is that real enjoyment? Or is it just what we expect to see and feel? We're just fitting in to our society. And it's really rebellious. That's why I like saying it. It's really just really going over the bounds of convention to say that sex is suffering. But what it does is open that possibility. And some of you remember just sexuality, or the sexual act. And some of you say, well, I can see there's a possibility that might be true. And look more deeply, and you find actually it is. Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha said, the enjoyment of sex is a perversion of perception. That's what he said. And when I saw that, I thought, wow. That's strong stuff. Now don't say that on Friday nights and not tomorrow. Okay, on retreats, because you guys are getting deeper into the reality of life. If I said that in these those sorts of talks on Friday night, people would walk out. I'm a crazy monk. What does he know? But look at it and think about it. Examine. You find there's a lot of truth there. And all that time, you've been sort of searching for this pleasure. And finding it's not pleasure after all, it's suffering. You've been sold a dud. You've been convinced by society this is one of the things which is really worthwhile investing so much energy for. And is it really worth it? Having children, is that happiness? So many people aspire for that. What really motivates your life? Being wealthy? Having kids? Having sex? It motivates many people's lives. Why? Because everybody else is doing it, that's why. But as a true seeker, you question and look and think and examine. And after a while you think, well, it's actually true. I've been sold a dud. I've just been following what other people are doing. Without really questioning these things. So I love really questioning. Even the most basic assumptions of life, question them. And that's in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Next question. In meditation to emptiness, is it easy to fall asleep? What skillful technique can you suggest? Okay, you can just sit on the stupa if you like, on the edge. You can sit in the dark, because in the dark there are all creeping things in this forest. You can find a cemetery to sit meditation in when the ghosts come. Actually, one of those ghost stories, I don't know if you know this ghost story, because you know the person who organized the opening ceremony, no, Liz Annan, Liz works in IT, and she got a contract some time ago to actually to reconfigure sort of the website of the funeral board. So she had to go to Karakata Cemetery and work there. And she's terrified of ghosts, and this is a cemetery. So she'd always make sure she arrived late after everybody else had gone to work, because she didn't want to be there by herself. But she worked there for a few days reconfiguring their website. And then it came to, I think she said it was a Saturday, and she had to go to work because she hadn't finished everything yet. But fortunately someone else was going to be in the office there, so she didn't mind, so she was working there. But it got to the point that the other person had to go home, and she hadn't finished it. She was very close to finishing the report. So she thought, ah, what the heck, I'll stay behind. So she was in the office of Karakata Cemetery alone on a Saturday afternoon with no one else there except maybe unseen beings. And all she was doing was printing out her report. And when she went to the printer, you could ask her this, when she went to the printer, all her pages were there, but right in the middle was a photograph of a grave in the middle of her printout. She never did this. She never sort of printed out a picture of a grave. So she immediately got in her car and drove all the way to South Perth and stopped at a coffee shop. She didn't care if her report was going to be late. She was really scared. And so on a Monday when she went back to work, she told them, I'm sorry, I couldn't do the report. When she told them what happened, they said, oh yeah, it's pretty common, these things happen. You know, you sort of do a print out of your work, and there's things which are not your work at all come out of the printer. And sometimes they have a meeting the next day in the offices, so they clean up the offices and set out the stuff, and it's all rearranged by Monday morning. So this is our local cemetery. So if you really want to stop soft and torpor, go and meditate there at night. But if meditation on emptiness is easy to fall asleep, yeah, you can fall asleep, but usually you wake up afterwards. If it really is making peace, being kind, being still, because you're being still, you're actually gaining energy, not losing energy. So eventually the energy just comes and you just can't go to sleep. You're fully awake. You've got energy. And energy comes from stillness. That's always the best way to overcome sloth and torpor. And I'd imagine that most of you, you were sleepy when you first came here. Like me, I was very sleepy. I've been working just like a dog the last month or two getting this place ready. And I was very sleepy. But I'm beginning to sort of get some energy coming up now because I'm being still. You're not doing so much. You're recovering. I think many of you, you were very sleepy the first couple of days, that's to be expected, and as the retreat wears on, you get more energy. Where does that energy come from? Because you've been still, you haven't been wasting it, thinking, worrying, planning, and doing so much. So this is actually where energy comes from stillness. If it's really stillness, you don't have to worry about falling asleep. So Ajahn, why is it important to get up and meditate in the early morning? Because the early morning is really cool and silent. And you know that, when did the Buddha become enlightened? Was it 4 o'clock in the afternoon? No. Was it 6 o'clock at night? No. The Buddha became enlightened at dawn. I'm not quite sure what it is or why it is, but so many people become enlightened at that time in the early morning. And think about it, you've only got 3 dawns left. 3 opportunities. So you can't miss any of them if you want to become enlightened. So you have to get up early, get your money's worth. So sometimes, and the reason is because you've had a good rest, so you should be sort of peaceful, you should be sort of free and just all the tiredness of the day has disappeared. And you've got like a fresh, clear mind if you slept well. So that's a very powerful time to become enlightened. In the early morning, after you've got up, before the dawn comes up. But if you get up after the dawn, you missed your chance again. So that's why it's great to get up early in the morning. It's always a quiet time. I love early mornings. I don't really like staying up late at night, but early mornings, I love them. Because most people in a place like Australia hate getting up early in the morning. So it's always a quiet time of day. They like staying up late at night, yeah. So there's always things happening at night. But early morning, everything is quiet and peaceful because most other people are in bed. They're not making any noise. So the early mornings are really quiet, and I love those early mornings. Next question. When is it skilled in meditation? When is it too little effort in meditation? When is too much effort forced? Well, I don't know what they mean by that, but skill in meditation, we call it skillful if it's going to be conducive to the goal of meditation. So what is the goal of meditation? And again, stillness, so nothing is moving. Because in that stillness, then you can see things as they truly are. And the similes of stillness are just like the lake of water. I mentioned that once. There's two similes for the lake of water. If that water's got waves on the surface, then it distorts the image of the full moon above, or the stars, or the mountains surrounding that lake. But only when that water is perfectly still is the surface of the water glassy smooth, and it's like a mirror, and you can see the full moon perfectly reflected. You can see the mountains and the forest perfectly reflected, only when the water is absolutely still. It's the same with the mind. Only when the mind is absolutely still is there no distortion of your perception. Only then do you see things as they truly are, when your mind doesn't move. And the other simile is not just looking at the reflection, but standing above and looking into that water. When that water is moving, again, it distorts the light coming from the bottom, so you can't see the pebbles on the bottom, you can't see the fish swimming in the water. When that water is agitated, you can't penetrate it with your vision. This is the Buddha simile. He said, but once that water is perfectly still, then you can look into it and see right down into its depths. Also, when it's agitated, it can actually stir up the mud and be a cloudy water. But when it settles, all the mud goes down to the bottom and then it becomes clear water. And that clear water, then you can see the fish in the water. Then you can see what's on the bottom. You can see right through it, only when the water is still. In the same way the Buddha said, when the mind is still, then you can see right into it. You understand what this mind truly is. So stillness is the goal. That's a great goal to actually to set for yourself, to be still. Because once you have a clear goal of stillness, then the means to achieve that goal become very clear. Once you have a destination, then you know the path. If you've got no destination, you're going to get confused. Which way should I go? So once you know the destination is stillness, and the path becomes so clear, every time you put forth effort, is that going to create stillness? Is this going to agitate your body and mind? Every time you want something, try something, you're just agitating yourself. You're moving away from stillness. But every time you make peace, you're kind, you're gentle, you're patient, you're creating stillness. So understanding that stillness is the goal. Stillness is the meaning of samadhi. The jhanas are deep states of stillness. Understanding that, the path becomes very clear to you, what you have to do to make this mind still. Every time you interfere with it, you agitate it. So that's the wrong path. Therefore, in that context, doing something is unskillful. In meditation, effort to do something, craving, ill will, whatever, is very unskillful in meditation. It's unskillful in the context because it goes against the goal. However, if you're helping Bianca cook, then it's very skillful to put forth effort and do things. if you are washing the toilet, it's very skillful to actually to move the hand and wash it properly. And if you're bringing the food to the monks, it's very skillful you not still and wait until the food is cold before we eat. When you drink this fast. So it depends on the context. That's why we call it skillful. We don't call it wrong or evil. That's why it's a beautiful word. It's skillful action or unskillful action depending upon the context. So when you're working, it's skillful to put forth effort. When you're driving your car, it's skillful not to watch the breath, but to watch the traffic. You know, when you're crossing the road, it's skillful to walk fast, not slow, because the context makes it skillful. It's not good or bad, it's just skillful in that context. So that's what the word skillful means. So meditation is certain skills are necessary to gain the goal of stillness. And too little effort and too much effort, the quantity of effort is not really the point, it's where the effort is directed. So actually, what are you trying to achieve with effort? And really, in meditation, it's the effort to stop, to restrain, to say no. That's the effort which is required in meditation. To abandon things, to let go of things, not to start new things. So understanding what the right effort is, to stop the controller, to let go of the doer, to prevent the mind moving, that's the effort required in meditation. It's not the effort to start new things and get more attainments or more experiences. So once you understand and can distinguish skillful effort from unskillful effort in meditation, then you find, you know, exactly what's supposed to happen. And you realize why many meditators, they waste so much time. Because, yeah, they're putting forth effort, but it's wrongly directed. They're putting forth effort to do something, to control the body, to make it still, to try and force their mind to be still. And they're just creating a lot of suffering for themselves. So understand the right effort, the skillful effort. It's not too much or too little. It's where it's focused. And are these perceptions defined by each individual situation? Yeah, they're in context. You talk about watching the breath. Out and in, out or out and in, or in and out. If this is done 10 hours a day, isn't it too much? Yeah. Not really, because your breath is going in and going out. It goes in and out 24 hours a day. Is that much if your breath has to do all that work for you? But it is much if you say, I've got to watch the breath for 10 hours. And why is that too much? It's because you allowed your perception to go off into the future. What is 10 hours anyway? There is no such thing as 10 hours. It's just this moment is all you've got. There is no such thing as sort of Wednesday, Thursday or Friday or Saturday. There's no such thing as the beginning or the end of this retreat. All there is this moment right now. It's amazing just how many perceptions we add on to reality, and those perceptions are what causes a lot of suffering. So don't even think about the end of the retreat, or don't even think about the end of this talk. It's just this moment is all you've ever got. So you just watch this breath happening now, and forget about the 10 hours which are in front of you. If you do things like that, meditation is so easy. Remember this time when I've been travelling in the north of Thailand all day, and it was a really hot day, and so you really get tired. And by the time I got to this monastery, it was about 5:30 in the afternoon. When I checked in, they said, oh, you're just in time for the 4-hour sit. What? Well, every evening they say from 6 till 10 we sit for 4 hours without moving. And that's, you know, it's okay maybe, but you know, when you're really tired, you've been working all day, walking all day, sorry. I was a bit sort of surprised at this. So fortunately, you had enough time to have a shower and get the dirt off your body. And they gave me a cup of Chinese tea, so there's not much caffeine in that. But nevertheless, I could sit down, and if I thought at that time, 4 hours of meditation, when you were sort of that tired, that was impossible. But you never think of 4 hours, you just think of this breath happening in this moment. That's all I thought about. just one breath at a time. And then what happened afterwards? They rang the bell at 10:15. And they were 1/4 hour short. And I complained, because I was having a great time. Why didn't he said 4 hours, it's only 3 3/4. You fortunate monks. So that's actually how you deal with such situations. You don't think of all the time which is in front of you, or all the time which is behind you. You just think what's happening right now. And the classic story of that was this New Zealand monk. His name was Han Wah. A long time ago, that when we Western monks were looking for a great place to practice, some of us went to stay in Thailand with monks like Ajahn Chah. But other Westerners, it didn't really matter. They didn't really care about whether they were Theravada, Mahayana, or Zen, or whatever. They just wanted to go to a place where it was a good practice. So some of them went to this monastery in Korea. And Korean Zen is really, really strict, very tough. These days, those Korean monks and nuns and the Theravada forest monks and nuns, we get on so well together because we do so many things the same. They really keep a very good form of Vinaya and training. And they do a lot of meditation, just like we do. But every year in this monastery, they'd have a retreat. 60-day retreat. And it was very different than the retreat you have here. This was one of those fierce retreats. 3 o'clock in the morning you got up. And it would be 50 minutes of meditation, 10 minutes of walking. 50 minutes of meditation, 10 minutes of walking. Throughout the whole day till about 11 o'clock at night. And when you got to 11 o'clock, you would sleep exactly where you were sitting. You just lay down there. So you couldn't go and escape to your own room. And sort of slip in an extra hour afterwards. And even if the only time you could leave the meditation hall was actually to go to the toilet or go and see the master for an interview. And the master was not like Ajahn Brahm. He was fierce! And it was so scary to go and see that master that they preferred just to stay and endure the pain. And even the food was taken where you sit, so there's no escape at all. But now this New Zealand guy, he was a very good meditator, a very tough nut, so he decided to do this 60-day retreat. And for those of you who've got some knee pain or back pain, just having to do all of that so many hours every day, his knees were just hurting so much and his back was in so much pain. After 4 or 5 days he thought he couldn't take any more. But he saw all of these Korean monks, all these Asians. And the Caucasians here, you know that one of the qualities of a Caucasian is they're very competitive and proud. And he thought, if all these Asians can sit for so long, I'm not going to give up. So it's just his pride kept him going for a few more days. And the pain never got less, but got worse. And after about 12 days, he just started really counting every day. 2 weeks, he figured out that's 1/4 way there. And he counted and counted, and when he got to about 3 weeks, he thought, if I give up now, all of the endurance so far would be for nothing. It'd be like being unfaithful to his effort. So he kept on pushing, even though sometimes he thought he was going to cry, he told me, out of pain. And then he got to the halfway mark, 30 days. And that was like a bit of a watershed. Because, you know, he'd done halfway, all downhill from here, so he thought. It doesn't work that way. Because usually, on a retreat, the pain gets worse on the second half of the retreat, not better. And so the days were just agonizingly slow. Incredible determination to endure all of that pain for such a long time. And of course, you count down the last week. Only 7 days to go. And he woke up one morning, you know, where he was sitting 3 o'clock for another day of torture. It was the last day. Imagine what it feels like. You've been in situations like that before. only one more day to go. Ah, he's going to make it. But the last day drags out for such a long time, as it does when you have that type of mind. But eventually he came to his last sitting, and his body was exploding in pain. And he said that last sitting was the worst of all. He said sometimes he really thought he couldn't stand it any longer, even though he'd only 50 minutes to finish the meditation and finish the retreat. Many times he thought he couldn't stand it and would get up because it hurt that bad. And every now and again he'd open his eyes and sneak a look at the clock. And that clock was going slower than he'd ever noticed before. He said he thought that maybe he had these terrifying ideas that perhaps the batteries of the clock were running out. He thought, what would happen if they did run out and the clock stopped 5 minutes before the end of the retreat and the master never noticed it? It could happen, you know. And he thought that's what was happening, because that last 50 minutes were like an eon for him. Every second dragged like an hour, and he was in such agony. And then he heard the gong, the sweetest sound he'd ever heard. The gong to end the retreat. Ah! Oh. And he said it was amazing that all the pain disappeared then. Because just the euphoria of having done something so difficult, 60 days of retreat and enduring so much pain, the pain disappeared. And at the end of these retreats, you know, in Korea, you have these hot baths, they have a big feast, they don't keep the 8 precepts, you can eat whatever you like afterwards, like a celebration of having just endured so much. And you thought, being on the hot bath, you can imagine with those achy knees and a painful back, the hot bath, oh yeah, and something to eat, you know, instead of just sitting where you are, and be able to walk outside and just having a really good sleep instead of sleeping on these hard mats where you are. And he was fantasizing about what was going to happen when the bell went again. And the master, the teacher, said, before we all go, I want to make an announcement. He said, during your interviews, I've heard that some of you have been having some very, very deep and good meditation. And you've asked me, can we extend the retreat for another week? And he said, I think this is a very good idea. The retreat is extended for another 7 days. Carry on meditating and sitting. And so he couldn't have his hot bath. He couldn't have his food. Another 7 days of torture. And he said he never felt any pain because his mind was consumed with the fiercest and hottest of anger. First of all, he wanted to find out who these damn monks were who suggested this. And then he was thinking of all the terrible torture he was going to inflict upon these. And the bell went again. About 15 minutes had gone past in a second. And the teacher said, retreat's over. Go to the bars and have something nice to eat. And poor old Ham Wall, New Zealand monk, he said he was totally confused. Is the retreat over or is it extended? What's going on? And it was at that point one of the other monks, one of the older monks who'd been there many years before, came up to him and said in English, the master does this trick every year. And he didn't know it was just a trick. And there he lay, he said he learnt so much from that experience. His pain came from expectation. Always so thinking, only one day to go, 30 minutes to go, 5 minutes to go. That causes the increase in your pain. And that's why the last hour is always the hardest. And the last 5 minutes is the most painful of that hour. Simply because of expectation, the mind runs off into the future. And the teacher was just teaching him. He thought, he'd finish. He was free. Another 7 days. He was so angry at that, because when you have expectation you get frustrated, and frustration is what causes anger. So when you have no expectations, you just have no frustration at all, and your anger just disappears. So that was a wonderful teaching. He said he learned more in that last 15 minutes than he'd learned for the whole 60 days. He learned about the nature of time. And it's not sort of 10 hours of watching the breath, it's only 1 minute of watching the breath, and anyone can do that. But if you start thinking 10 hours, it becomes impossible. Even this retreat center, when you look at the plans, it's impossible to build. But it's done one brick at a time, raising the funds of 5 million, $1 at a time, 50 cents at a time. Many hours, days, years of work. And if I'd have thought about how much work it was, I'd have thought, no, I'm not going to do this. I can't do this. This is too much. But you never think like that as a monk. One bit at a time, one day at a time, $1 at a time. And now you have a beautiful retreat center. That's actually how we meditate. That's how we work as a monk. One step at a time. So don't become a prisoner of time by allowing time to sort of scare you and think, how many more hours have I got to enjoy this? There will come a time when you'll be in great pain. Maybe you're very sick, close to death, maybe. And sometimes you may think, I can't endure this pain any longer. The problem is the concept, any longer. You're enduring the pain now. That's all you need to worry about in this moment. When you think longer, 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 that's when the torture really bites and you can't stand it. Understand the nature of time and understand its expectations are what causes a problem. Even in meditation, please have no expectations. And to have no expectations, just stay in the present moment, just be now. And you're so free. So that's actually how we understand this and how we can let go of this. So it's not a question of meditating for 10 hours. Just meditate for a moment. And then the next moment, just 10 hours goes by. Easy. So that's how we meditate, and that's why you don't keep a clock and see how many hours you can meditate, and you don't try and beat your record or go in the Guinness Book of Records for the longer person who sat the longest in meditation. Ajahn Chah was very, very sharp on that. He said, if you really think that you've got to sit for 10 hours to meditate, if you really think that's important, the length of time you meditate, then you should assume that all the chickens in the world are enlightened. Because those chickens sit on their eggs for days, not just 10 hours, without moving. And if they sit so still, and that's the reason they got enlightened, all the chickens will be enlightened. That's why we call people who sit long periods of time, just to beat their record, we call them chicken meditators. So don't be a chicken meditator. It's not how long you sit, but the quality of your sitting makes you enlightened. And don't worry whether it's 5 minutes or 10 hours, as long as it's good quality. And that means that sort of you understand the nature of this moment. And then you're free of time. So what time is it now? Good, thank you very much. I look at the clock, it's now minutes past now. On the Nauth day of the Nauth month, 2000 and now. It's now time. So understanding that, you just get so free of all this problem of time. And time can torture you. In a moment, you're free. Okay, so those are the questions. I managed to tease out the last question. So I'd keep the time. It's 3 minutes past nine, actually. So thank you for the questions today. And the evening is still young. What time would you normally go to bed if you were at home? But as a meditation now, maybe go to bed a bit earlier. So if you've got energy, meditate. And if you are sleepy, go and meditate outside, because sometimes in a room it's a bit warm and it gets a bit sleepy, but over in the forest over there it's more alive and easier to meditate. Or do some walking meditation. If you are going to meditate in your room, please meditate a long way from your pillow. Because on meditation retreats, pillows are magnetic. They pull your head to them very easily. But anyway, have a nice evening, and I'll see you tomorrow morning. Thank you for listening.